KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
The federal government doled out a lot of money during the COVID-19 pandemic. It came in waves and went in a lot of different directions, but there was a consistent focus on schools.
These were tied to the big COVID relief packages that covered a lot more than education. So basically, there's an education element to each of the three big COVID relief packages that flowed through Congress.
That is Lindsay Dworkin. She is Senior Vice President of Policy and Government Affairs for NWEA, a K-12 assessment and research organization. Now, that month, money referred to as ESSER funds has an expiration date, and while tens of billions of dollars have been spent by school systems across the country, there are still tens of billions of dollars that have to be spent by the end of September. In this episode of KYW News Radio In Depth, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers, get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. We talk with Lindsay Dworkin about how that money has been and will be spent, what it has been spent on, and just how impactful the money has been. So let's start out with a baseline. What are ESSER funds?
Yes. Well, for those of you who like acronyms, ESSER stands for the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Funds. And these were funds that came in three waves from the federal government to what are called local education agencies, but basically school districts and charter schools to help address wide range of needs out of the pandemic. So actually, the funds were highly, highly flexible. And they 20% of them had to be used on academic recovery, but the rest were just to give, basically make money no object as schools and districts confronted, sort of beginning with the, we've got to get schools reopened, we've got to figure out a way to make schools safe and available for kids, all the way through, what do we do now that everybody's back and we've got sort of big learning disruptions to address.
And you mentioned three waves. Was that the plan, or was this, there was a wave of money and then it was learned that's not going to be enough, or we've got to do something else, and then another wave, and then another wave? Was it originally supposed to be in three different installments, or was that just the way it worked out?
No, I think that's more just the way it worked out. So as sort of time unfolded, I mean, these the sort of first funds became available in March of 2020. So it's just about 4 years ago, and it was right as schools were closing. There were no vaccines. We had no idea how long it would last. Kids were all being sent home. Not every kid had a device. There was no thought about what this virtual school might look like. Sort of things were a huge mess. And there was sort of one wave of funding that was really about get schools open. We've just got to find a way to get kids back. We've got to find a way to get, you know, back when it was like, what needs to happen to HVAC systems? These schools need vats of hand sanitizer. We were like flooding schools with decontaminants every night. I mean, just all of that. So it was initially a really emergency. How do we make the building safe? How do we get kids back? And then ultimately, as things unfolded and it was clear for most of the country that it was going to be quite a while before kids were actually coming back into buildings, making sure that every kid got a device and then sort of access to broadband became a big focus. I think after, you know, sort of months and months into that, there sort of became, and this was, these were tied to the big COVID relief packages that covered a lot more than education. So basically, there's an education element to each of the three big COVID relief packages that flowed through Congress. So it became clear that the learning disruptions were going to be much bigger than anybody had thought at the beginning, and certainly that we'd hoped, and that they were going to be more persistent. And so the money sort of, as it rolled, there was more and more focus put on actually addressing, you know, less the we got to get kids a device and back in school and the buses running again and all of that, to gosh, what are we going to do now that kids are really back in buildings, but we still have lots of lost ground and student growth and achievement to address.
Ballpark, how much money are we talking, and how was it? It went from the feds to the states, and then the states would distribute to the districts, or it didn't go right from the federal government to the districts, right?
Yeah. No, you've got it. So $190 billion in total. And the money flowed, just like Title I funds do, sort of flowed through the states to districts. I think it was about 10% that states could hold back for initiatives at the state level, but 90% of it flowed out to districts and charter schools. There's about $53 billion left to spend. So it hasn't, and actually initial spending was pretty slow. There was some sort of concern at the beginning that, oh my gosh, there's going to be all of this ESSER money left over. Districts and schools aren't going to have a chance to spend it. That has not really panned out. Sort of as the pandemic and recovery period has progressed, spending has really picked up. And now in sort of the $53 billion that's remaining that has to be obligated, so not actually spent and out the door, but committed to buying something, even though the contracts can extend past the date, is the end of September of this year. So this is really the last school year where most districts and schools will have what amounts to, on average, about 10% of their of additional funding over their usual budgets.
Why put an expiration date, like the end of September, that this money, I guess it has to be spent or accounted for by then, as you said? Like, why do that? Is that just to make sure that from an accounting purpose that you know this money's gone, like in the checkbook? Or what is there a reason why you put an expiration date on something like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the original, you know, it's actually, you're not the first person who's asked that question. I think it's a really interesting question. I think a big part of it was this was supposed to be emergency response. So this was not supposed to be money for, you know, states and districts to just sit on in perpetuity until they had a good idea to spend it. It was like, particularly in the first wave of funding, we've got to get schools open, right? Kids have got to get back in school, and we need there to be plenty of money. And we don't know how much that's going to cost. We don't know what that's going to look like, but we've just got to let there be federal resources to support that happening. So I think it was partly to light a fire under schools and districts to actually spend. I'm sure there is a, you know, it's tied to other pools of funding that also have deadlines. So I think that's part of it too. But it was not ever meant to be a sort of permanent fixture of the federal funding system for schools. It was sort of this big surge of funding to address whatever needed to happen to the immediate aftermath of the sort of early days of the pandemic and then going forward. But certainly, as we have learned, the academic disruptions have been much, much deeper than any of us had hoped. And they've been much more, the gaps have been much more persistent than we would like to see, particularly for historically underserved students, students of color, students in low-income schools. And I think the fact that this money is expiring really will hinder the ability of schools to help close some of those gaps.
You mentioned some things, you know, talking about getting schools safe and HVACs and stuff like that early on. Do we have a feel, and we're obviously painting with a broad brush here because we're talking all over the country, but do we have a feel for the types of impact this money have? Like, have there been studies or articles about this money that's already been spent, like how it has helped or the impact it has had?
Yeah, there's been, I mean, it's, as you say, all across the country, spending happening in, you know, more than 10,000 school districts across the nation. So I think some of those studies are just now beginning to happen and some of that data to be gathered. So, I mean, in terms of like amounts of money and what it's been spent on, Future Ed has a really good tracker. If you Google Future Ed ESSER funds, you can find it. Or the Edgenomics Lab and Marguerite Rosa has been tracking some of this. I think the studies that I've seen about effectiveness have looked at like particular programs that money has been spent on and the effectiveness of those efforts. So, I mean, the really good news is that there is some really strong evidence about some academic interventions that have been really successful in places they've been implemented. So high dosage tutoring is one of those. You've probably, you know, there's been a lot of coverage about this, even in the mainstream media, about kids who receive tutoring sort of intensively in small groups or just that or individually for 3 times a week for like 50 hours or more a semester make noticeable progress relative to their peers that don't get that. So that's been sort of, and we've known that a little bit prior to the pandemic. It's been tried in bigger scale now. And that is something that I actually think we'd look to what could future needs be that could be supported by federal funds to help continue recovery. I think having there be, you know, sort of a permanent fixture of our education system, opportunities to do things like high dosage tutoring could be really effective. I think also like adding instructional times of any sort. So there's the tutoring, but also summer learning, extending the school day, and then just generally efforts to keep kids in school, because the data is so strong that if chronic absenteeism, you know, kids who are absent more than 14 days a year, students who are even partially absent lots of days a year, just, you know, for some obvious reasons, don't do as well, don't stay engaged and don't make progress. And those numbers, the numbers of kids who are missing part or all of a school day more than doubled during the pandemic and have not come down to pre-pandemic levels. So say there's some real bright spots that have emerged that have been made possible out of the funding. In terms of like how much did the overall funding move the system as a whole? I think it's really hard to tell, especially given that the uses of the funding, as we were just talking about, sort of went from HVAC systems and hand sanitizer, and I think have transitioned to academic interventions in a more intensive way. So we didn't start off in March of 2020 with a whole bunch of academic, you know, support for students. We started off with really these sort of emergency measures. But I think if there were ever more federal funding to support pandemic recovery, if it was focused in the academic space, it could be really, really powerful and really help move the needle and close some of the gaps that, of course, existed pre-pandemic, but have just become even wider and more persistent.
We need to take a break on KYW News Radio In Depth. We will have more on ESSER funds with Lindsay Dworkin in just a few moments. But right now, there's nothing quite like the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid when it comes to exhilarating efficiency. With hybrid technology and thrilling capability, these vehicles deliver an electrifying performance on every drive. This new year, discover for yourself what truly makes these hybrids special. Redefine your driving experience with Honda. KBB.com's best value brand of 2023. Contact your local Honda dealer today about the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid. And now on KYW News Radio In Depth, let's return to our conversation about ESSER funds with Lindsay Dworkin. She is NWEA's Senior Vice President of Policy and Government Affairs.
The money that's left, let's just for argument's sake, it doesn't get used for whatever reason by the end of September. Does it just go back into the treasury? What happens? Because I'm always fascinated with these big numbers. You see this a lot with corporations where, you know, you hear these hundreds of millions of dollars and then it just kind of either disappears or just gets moved around on a spreadsheet. Like what would happen to this money in theory? Does it just go back to the government?
Yeah, I know. Crazy, right? Yes. In theory, it would. It could be, it would just revert back to the department, to U.S. Department of Education. Though it is, even despite the sort of initial slow pace of funding, from all the sources I've seen, the Department of Education itself, and then these other groups that are trying to track, I do think the vast majority, if not all of it, will get spent. So I think that's really not a concern. And that even, and of course, the tracking on the spending is slow because it doesn't, like, as districts obligate the funds, which just means like they sign a contract for something, that money is not showing up as spent in the system. So there's actually more money probably obligated and spent than is even showing up in the trackers that are showing only, you know, $53 billion left to go.
One of the things that's interesting that I never would have thought of, but it makes sense when you kind of learn about it, is, and I in no way want to paint like more money going to schools as a bad thing, but one thing I've learned is when you get money like this that has a quote unquote expiration date, it can be challenging for districts because, yes, you can maybe add a French program if you didn't have one, or add an after school tutoring program if you didn't have one. But the problem is, like, when the money disappears, then all of a sudden that becomes another line on your ledger that you're going to have to use your regular funding for. And that can be challenging, and it does make it challenging to try to improve things, but don't get yourself in a situation where then you end up cutting, because I feel like you will get more grief for cutting something than you would get praise for bringing it, even if in for a short time.
Yeah, you're totally right. You're totally right. So the fact that this money had an expiration date has made it harder to spend all along for exactly what you've just described. Like, districts have all sorts of ideas about staffing they'd like to add, programs they'd like to add, but have been really reluctant to invest in things that are going to require long-term funding to support when they know that funding will go away. So of course, you know, you can use one-time funding to put in a new HVAC system or buy everybody a laptop once, but the actual structural changes and support that you'd want to see sort of in the long term for like this generation of students, like continuous high dosage tutoring or, you know, all the things the evidence says works, really, really hard to staff up and spend money and start those things knowing that you've got such a short window of time. So I totally agree. And, you know, particularly with the benefit of hindsight about how much disruption there's been to students' growth, if there had been some combination of the emergency get schools open funding and then some much longer term commitment to, we're going to maintain some kind of recovery funds for, you know, 10, 15 years, understanding that really this students who were in elementary school, you know, starting in kindergarten, even students who were in preschool are still feeling the effects of having had their academic experience interrupted by this national, you know, international disaster, that we could have understood that that was going to take more than just a couple of years of resources to support.
One thing that's interesting is the money comes down the pike, you know, big swaths of it. And then it's up to the schools to figure out, okay, how do we spend this? Would it be easier if it was reversed, if the schools put together the list of things they wanted and then said, here's what we wanted. Can we get the money for that? Would it move things along? And obviously, this is easy to say, and, you know, you're not second guessing a global pandemic. But did it present unique challenges that schools are almost to that point, like, oh my God, we've got this money, we've got to spend it, but we don't want to spend it, so that we end up having to cut things down the road? Like, if it was reversed, would we maybe see more money spent, easier to spend, and spent in specific ways?
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, obviously, spending would look more intentional if the plans had come before the money. And in this case, certainly with the first wave of funds, the objective was get money into the hands of schools and districts as fast as you can so that whatever they need, they can buy it, they can get the kids back in school. The result, though, was that money was sort of sitting in pots, and then the plans were sort of coming after the money was rolling, and it was sort of a lot. And at the same time, that the same leaders who were asking to come up with transformational plans with this money that has fallen in their lap are having to deal with, how do I set up hybrid learning? How do I teach all of my teachers how to log into Zoom? How do I get everybody a device? And so, you know, we've heard lots of stories about just the overload on district leaders, school leaders, and trying to manage through all of that. So no surprise that we did not get coherent, brilliant, transformative plans for this huge influx of federal money that was, to the conversation we were just having, short term, which then makes it harder to plan for. So tension between getting money out fast and waiting for districts and schools to come up with good plans for it, I think just they got much more planful as time went on. So the money starts rolling, the emergency, so we go through 2 years of real disruption to the like mechanics of the school day. And then in the last 2 years have seen a real turn of the system toward, what do we do about academic recovery? How do we support student learning? I guess it's a mixed bag. And I think it would have been hard to say we're going to go come up with a plan while your schools are closed and hold the money until then. But certainly, I think if we were going to see additional federal money come into the system, I would be in support of saying we need a real smart plan and to show that you're going to spend it on evidence-based stuff that we know is going to move the needle for kids.
And kind of to that point, as a follow-up to that, like, are there lessons we have learned going forward? Not like for the next time there's a giant emergency and we have to throw money into the education system. But are there things that the last few years and maybe with this funding that we have learned that can be utilized kind of going forward when it comes to budgeting, when it comes to what's important, when it comes to what to focus on, things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, that a bright side of the pandemic in schools is that it brought this incredible attention to the digital divide and making sure all kids are online, have broadband. And we went from largely being a country of with a ratio of 2 kids per device to a 1-to-1 device to kid ratio. And that has stayed with us. So that is an incredibly powerful transformation that now, I mean, it's not perfect, but on average, every kid has access to a device. And there's been just so much more attention and money rolling, including in like some of the recent infrastructure support coming from the feds to get it, making sure everybody, families and kids and schools can all be online with high quality internet. So that's great. I think on the sort of other lessons learned, and, you know, I've been using high dosage tutoring as an example, the stuff that works, we continue to get evidence that it works. So high dosage tutoring had some evidentiary base prior to the pandemic. It now has even stronger evidentiary support. This is something that moves the needle. Problem is implementation and scaling is so hard. So it's not, you know, there's often, I think, in education, we've got to go figure out some new strategies. What's actually going to help kids learn? I think we know what helps kids learn. It's just that, you know, we often try it in one classroom or one school in a small district. And then we say, okay, and now we're going to try to do this statewide across Pennsylvania. And suddenly it all falls down in, you know, the real hard work of how do you hire hundreds of thousands of tutors? How do you get them to students? Can you do that effectively virtually? Do you actually have to deploy people into classrooms? And so the hard work ahead of us is how we get right the implementation and then how we find in an era where I'm not immediately optimistic about more federal funds, although I really think they are necessary, that we sort of sustain the kind of intensive support we need for the kids who fell the furthest behind. And that's, you know, historically underserved students and students in low-income schools. They desperately need continued support of the kind that we've just been really ramping up the last couple of years. And to have that money and then all of those interventions fall sort of off this fiscal cliff is going to be really unfortunate. So I do hope states can step up. I hope the feds eventually step up with some more funds. Philanthropy is usually there to help in sort of concentrated areas. But, you know, we'll see what happens.
That's it for this episode of KYW News Radio In-Depth, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. You can listen to the podcast free anytime on the Odyssey app, and you can find it wherever you listen to your favorite shows. I'm Matt Leon, and we'll have another episode out soon.